Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Intercooler podcast is sponsored by JBR Capital, one of the UK's leading car finance specialists. Now, we only partner with like-minded organisations who really understand what it means to be a car enthusiast, and JBR Capital is a perfect fit for us. It's run by people who really love cars, and importantly, vehicle finance is all JBR Capital does. That alone is what the company exists to do. So whether you're looking to fund a classic, sports car, supercar or hypercar, see what JBR Capital can do for you. And it's not just about very high-end, expensive unobtainium. In fact, the minimum borrowing is £25,000 and the average, £80,000. Head to JBR Capital on social media or jbrcapital.com online and tell them the Intercooler sent you. Right, let's get on with this week's podcast.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 101. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. Andrew, now we're talking about innovation and perhaps also a little bit of rule bending in motorsport. Inspired by the updated Mercedes W13 F1 car. Can you explain, please, for people who might not know?
Well, not really, no, because that would presuppose that I had some understanding of the current F1 rulebook, which I don't. But, okay, all I do know is that at the first pre-season test at Barcelona, they turned up with one car. They appeared to have turned up in Bahrain with another. And the thing about it is it's got no side pods, which I think means... it's clearly a packaging miracle because of all the stuff that you got to stick into those side pods, the pipes and the radiators and this, that and the other, which I presume means it's going to be a... It's not going to have much drag at all. So I presume the idea is that it's just going to be a really, really quick car. And I think the crucial thing is that nothing gets in the way of the airflow to the back of the car. And there is some aperture, some square-shaped aperture that's meant to be there, which isn't. And this has sent the paddock into paroxysms of outrage. Christian Horner in particular, who gave an interview to Automotor and Sport, saying that he thought that what Mercedes had done was outside the spirit of the regulations. I think Red Bull then denied it and then said, okay, it wasn't an official comment. But I don't think
it is. If it comes from your team principal, it's an official comment. You know,
He wasn't speaking in his official capacity. I don't know. Okay. What I do know is it's a joke. I mean, of all people, well, of all teams, certainly the team that employs Adrian Newey, who has sailed closer to the regulatory wind than any other designer in the modern history of racing. And quite rightly so, to say, oh, it's not in the spirit of the regulations. And you know, as I put in a tweet, you know, if Adrian had gone to Christian Horner with that idea, do you think Christian would have gone, well, that's a really good idea, Adrian, but I just don't think it's really in the spirit of the regulations, so we'll park it. He would have gone, bring it on. And that's the point, isn't it? These are regulations. They don't have spirits. That's why they're regulations. And, you know, the whole part of the game is, it's like, you know, everybody tries to buy themselves an advantage, whether it's with a more powerful engine or with a better driver. And this, and you know, the rule book is the same. You take what you're given and you do the most you can with it. And if the car is not illegal, if the rules are bent, squeezed, stretched, don't matter. As long as it's not, they're not actually broken, you can do it. And Red Bull would be the first, and given all the stuff that's gone on, would be the absolute first to acknowledge that. And, you know, and to me, if, and I don't even think we've seen that yet, maybe by the time this goes out on Monday, Mercedes will have banged in some amazing time. As we're recording this on Friday morning, it hasn't shown itself to be any faster yet, but maybe no. They haven't tried to go fast with it. But if they have happened to steal a march over the entire F1 grid, well, you know, good luck to them. They just
and as long as it's legal,
as long as it's legal, no one has any grounds for complaint at all. If it's illegal, if it does break the rules, I mean, even Ross Brawn, I mean, the man behind the double diffuser, which was another brilliant interpretation of the rules, which basically gave Brawn the world championship in 2009, well, with a Mercedes engine, of course. Even Ross Brawn said this was an extreme interpretation of the rules. Fine. Interpret them as extremely as you like, as long as you're not actually breaking them, you know, don't matter. I suspect there might be something else going on here, because I'm not really usually conspiracy theorist, but I love the idea of, and Ross used to do this with Brawn in 2009, when he realised that the car was so competitive, and he told me this once, they'd stick stuff on it, which didn't do anything at all, just to play with the minds of the other teams. And the rule was, as long as it didn't make the car slower or less reliable, you could put it on the car. And so they stick this stuff on, everybody's like, oh my God, what's this they come up with? And they go and analyse it, and all this is taking up time of your opponents, and distracting them. And I don't know if there's not an element of that in what Mercedes is up to. It's certainly, if the intention was to wind up Red Bull, and who knows, goodness knows, after the back end of last season, you know, you'd understand why Mercedes might want to do that. Then it's job done, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, we can talk about the spirit of the regulations, but the And the spirit of F1, at least from a designer's point of view, that's what this is all about. Interpreting the rules and being creative and red herrings, perhaps, that throw your rivals off the scent. I think there is also some discussion around the legality of the mirrors. And apparently there is an agreement that mirror supports will not be used as wings. So I think some teams are unhappy about that. But the FIA has said so far that there's nothing illegal on that car. And it might yet be that one team or another, guess which one it might be, objects, and then there, I guess there has to be an investigation. And actually, if 8 teams object to something, the rules can be rewritten. So this is a dynamic thing. It's in flux, isn't it?
So if you do something which is completely legal and completely brilliant, and you spend a huge amount of time and resource over the winter because you've had this brilliant idea, if all the other teams go, we didn't think of that, then they can render all that work useless.
I presume there has to be grounds for it. Maybe there's something that contravenes the rules.
We don't like that car because it's quicker than ours.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a mechanism that stops it just being about...
I guess the big problem with this season, and again, I don't know the ins and outs of the regs, but because it's the start of the new rules regime and so much of the design of the car is kind of fixed, it may be that they are pretty limited as to what they, as to how they'll be able to respond to it. I don't know. But and you know, you could have one of these terrible situations where, and I'm not saying this is the case at all because we haven't seen any evidence for the car speed yet, not certainly as we record this, but you know, if Mercedes has really stolen the march, it could be game over before the season starts.
Yeah, and the key thing is, it's all about engine packaging, isn't it? Powertrain packaging. And if you can't, you can't just totally redesign that in a season, I wouldn't have thought.
I don't know.
So, I mean, if it turns out to be a huge advantage, then that's just going to compound throughout the year. There was this amazing shot of the Aston Martin, which has the Mercedes power unit with the rear bodywork removed. And you see these enormous compartments on the side where the AirPods are. They look like luggage compartments. And I thought, and I tweeted this, that car's got more storage capacity than my A110. There's something curious. Why wouldn't Aston Martin have created similar side pods to shrink wrap around that power unit?
Maybe because they thought that they couldn't. People just thought you can't do that because they thought the rules stop you doing it. So, I mean, I don't. I mean, if it's illegal, chuck it out. Absolutely, chuck it out. But you can't chuck it out because the other teams don't like it.
No, that shouldn't be how it works.
They kick up a fuss. No, it shouldn't. No, I mean, you know, the rules are the rules, and if they break, chuck it out. If not, let them race.
Good. Okay. Well, we're actually not going to talk in too much detail about how the side pod design works and so on. There'll be others who do that
better. I'm so glad about that.
But we are going to just use this as a sort of an excuse to talk about innovation and rule bending in motorsport, because there are some brilliant examples of it through history. And it's at this moment, we don't know if Mercedes' interpretation of the rulebook here is going to work in its favour or not. So we're not just going to talk about the innovation and the rule bending that's led to championship winning success. We've got a few flops that we're going to talk about as well, because, I don't know, the zero pod or the hide pod, as some have called it, that might turn out to be a flop. The non-pod, that might turn out to be a flop. So we'll have to wait and see until the first race of the season, won't we? Which is not far away. We're going to be talking about slipping through the regulatory net, finding and exploiting loopholes, which actually for me is what F1 and racing car design is all about. You're going to get us underway, Andrew. You've sent me an enormous list.
Yes.
We're not going to get through all of them, but I do want to talk about number one on your list, which is the 1939 Mercedes W165.
Yeah, okay. Before we do that, can I talk about number zero, which isn't on the list, because I only thought of it this morning.
Okay, we'll start at zero.
But it does directly relate to this, because as I'm sure a lot of people know, in Grand Prix racing in the late 1930s, Auto Union, and particularly Mercedes-Benz, were just like so much better than anybody else. People wondered why they turned up, because they produced these insane cars. I mean, the W125... had a 5.6 litre supercharged engine which developed 646 horsepower in 1937. It would be the turbo era of Formula One before Grand Prix cars had more power than that. And so how do you beat that? Well, okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is Alfa Romeo's answer to that, which absolutely didn't work, but it was just brilliant. They only had an engine. So this Mercedes had this enormous 5.66 litre engine. And the biggest engine Alfa Romeo had was a 3.2. So their brilliant idea was, we'll use two of them. And they produced this thing called the Bimotore. And it had an engine in the front and it had an engine in the back. It produced amazing power. But it was just rear wheel drive. I think it was quite cumbersome. I think it was quite heavy. And I do know it had a particular problem that it would eat tyres within minutes of starting to race. But it was just, that's a kind of like a desperation response, isn't it? You know, we must do something, this is something, therefore we must do it. And I think they made two, at least one of them still survives. And I think somebody's made a replica, but yeah, I just didn't want to carry on without at least doffing my cap to the Alfa Romeo Bimotore. So yes, the W165, as a direct response to this total Mercedes domination.
That's familiar.
For the Tripoli Grand Prix in 1939, Libya at that time was an Italian protectorate. And the people who were being hammered most by the dominance of the Germans were the Italians, Alfa Romeo and Maserati in particular. And so they thought that they would just arrange it so that there was no way the Germans could win. And so they said, okay, we're going to make, for this particular Grand Prix, we're going to make it a 1.5 litre race. So if you haven't got a car with a 1.5 litre engine, you can't come. And Mercedes didn't. And they thought that was fantastic. So, you know, the Maseratis will come and it'll be great and it'll be an Italian victory and an Italian protectorate and bish, bash, bosh. Unbeknownst to them, in like no time at all, Mercedes thought, well, we're not taking this line down, we'll just design one.
In months.
And so they created, in months, this little exquisite jewel of a car. And the specification, 1.5 litre, V8, four overhead camshafts, four valves per cylinder. This is before the war. Four valves per cylinder, four overhead camshafts, supercharged. They made two cars. They went and they did that one race. They came first and second, and they never raced again. Completely new car. just because.
That's amazing.
Just out of spite, just out of sheer, you know, sod you. We're not gonna, you know, we're not gonna be ruled out because you don't like us because we've done our job better than you. If that's what you're gonna do, well, we'll play to those rules and we'll still beat you. And they did.
There was an echo of that last year. So the point about the Tripoli GP in 1939 was that the regulations were totally rewritten in an effort to stop Mercedes winning.
Yes.
And in 2021 in F1, we know we've got new regulations that a cutaway in the floor, which was actually specifically designed to hurt Mercedes. And yet they still won the constructors' title. So, yeah, not quite as extreme as that 1939 car, but there was an echo of it there.
Designed a new car. Yeah, I thought that was extraordinary. Yeah.
That's brilliant.
And, oh, sorry, yeah, just on that, I did drive it once. I did drive the winning car. Mercedes brought it over to the Festival of Speed. And because it was designed to do one race, all the bits that exist for that car are in the car. There are no spares. It's still the same everything with which it won that race. Now, they've had the engine apart and they've cleaned it up and it's fine. And so, but you can imagine, this thing was just like, everything was bespoke. It was unique to that car. And when I drove it, I was so tentative and so nervous. And the Mercedes guys going, no, you can't do that. It's a Grand Prix car. It's a 1930s Grand Prix car. You can't drive it like that. You have to drive it. And I was talking to them about how to get it off the line. And they said, spin the wheels. So I did. So I just gave it everything. I gave it like 8,500 and dropped the clutch and off we went. And if you drove it like that, it was fine.
It's fine.
Good as gold. Hated being driven slowly. Just wood couldn't be driven slowly. It just couldn't do it. So yeah. Anyway.
What on earth is that thing worth? Best not think about it if you're about to drive the thing. Okay. All right, let's clip along a little bit.
Yeah.
I think we can rattle this one off quite quickly. Jaguar C-Type disc brakes. I mean, yeah, this isn't just about rule bending, is it? It's about innovation in racing. And that is as good an example as any, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, everybody knew the disc brake was fantastic because it had been around for a long time in aircraft. It was just a much more efficient way of losing speed. You didn't suffer the fade that you got with drum brakes because the heat didn't build up inside the drum because there wasn't a drum, you know, and everybody. But no one could make a disc brake go around a corner. You know, aircraft, they use their disc brakes kind of once every flight, and they only travel in a straight line, so it's easy. And Jaguar, particularly, and Dunlop, and guys like Norman Jewis and Stirling Moss, they perfected it. And we'll be quick with this because I think everybody knows the story. In 1953, they went to Le Mans with a C-Type fitted with disc brakes, Tony Rolton, Duncan Hamilton dusted the lot. And, you know, it was simply a matter of time after that before every single racing car from then on and for all eternity was fitted with discs. So there you go.
Okay, good. Right, we're a year later now, but back to Mercedes. Yeah. W196. Yeah. Now, there are two reasons that this car was a proper innovator or a bit of a rule bender. You only listed one reason. So if you can give us that, I'll jump in with the second.
So this was Desmodronic valve gear. One of the reasons that that car was... I'm just trying to figure out what the second one is that you're going to come up with. I'm looking forward to that. It didn't have valve springs. The limiting factor in many engines, particularly back then, as to how fast you could spin it, was the frequency of response to the valve springs. And, you know, if you went beyond what the valve springs would tolerate, you got pistons meeting valves and expensive noises and retirements from motor races. And so Desmodronic valve gear, instead of having a valve spring, it's a mechanically operated valve. So it literally mechanically picks up the valve, which means you can spin it much higher. And the result is higher revving, more power, but also much greater reliability. It was very, very difficult to break. And one thing we do know about the Mercedes in that, and it was in obviously the W196 Grand Prix car and the very closely related 300 SLR sports car, is that they were very fast and they hardly ever broke. Over to you.
Okay, well, there was another version of the W196, and that was the Type Monza.
The Strömlinger, the Streamliner.
Yeah, which is unusual because it was a Formula One car, but it had closed wheels. So it looks like a sports car, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely right, yeah.
And they called it the Type Monza. And it won three championship F1 races, the 54 French Grand Prix and the 54 and 55 Italian Grand Prix, all with Fangio. So it helped Fangio to the 54 title, his second. And it remains the only F1 car with closed wheels to win in F1 history.
And if you think about where it raced in France at Reims and Monza, pretty much the two fastest tracks in Grand Prix racing at that time.
Yeah, very, very low drag car. So it was just a rocket down the straights. And it's unusual when you see photos of it on the F1 grid alongside a load of open wheel F1 cars. It looks like a sports car in an F1 race. It's really odd.
Fangio hated it, actually. And I think they raced it at Silverstone in 54 as well. And it didn't work because back then I think the course was like sort of laid out with oil drums and that sort of thing. And Fangio kept on clouting them because he couldn't see the corners of the car. He couldn't see where the car ended. And he didn't like it. But somewhere like Monza, and particularly Reims, which is just basically straights connected by a very small number of corners, fantastic.
Okay. Oh, we're a year later again. God, this was an era for racing, wasn't it? The 50s. We're at 1955. Number four on your list. Can you pick up the story, please? Amazing looking car.
Okay, I haven't got it. I haven't got my list in front of it. Are you talking about the Nardi?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I think this comes under the category of flop. The Nardi Bicelluro. Go look it up. I mean, again, it's a cracking idea. It's basically, if you think of a catamaran, it's a automotive racing version of that. So you have two booms, and in one side you put a driver, and in the other side you put the engine. So the car's like perfectly balanced. And this had a little 750cc engine. And I think the thing was, and it was incredibly aerodynamic. It was so slippery, and it was so light. And I think it was a great concept. But, I mean, it certainly raced at Le Mans in 55, which people tend to remember, understandably, for fairly tragic reasons. But it didn't work because it was literally, and I do mean literally, it was blown off the track by a passing D-type Jaguar.
Really?
Because although it was incredibly aerodynamically slippery, I don't think it was desperately stable, as a lot of aerodynamically very slippery cars tend not to be. And so that's what happened. It was blown off the track. I don't think anything happened to it, but it was a kind of great idea, but probably greater in theory than in reality.
Yeah, so it raced at Le Mans in 55. It looks like two cigar tubes sort of strapped together, or almost like a motorcycle and sidecar. It's an unusual looking thing. Okay, let's clip along a little bit. So, yeah, you've also mentioned the 1957 Cooper T43, the first mid-engined F1 car. And it won with Stirling Moss driving the 58 Argentine Grand Prix. Okay, let's keep moving though, because there's one number seven on your list I really want to talk about. Number six, by the way,
just on the Cooper, and the reason we should be quick about it is although it was the first mid-engine car in Formula One, it wasn't the first mid-engine Grand Prix car, because Auto Union were doing mid-engine Grand Prix cars in the 1930s. And I've always puzzled as to why that wasn't carried forward. Because we know about low polar moments of inertia and reduced frontal area and everything, all the benefits that mid-engine cars bring. But it was the first mid-engine Formula One car. It did change the course of Formula One history. In 1957, it was the only one. By 1961, every single car on the grid was mid-engine. So, I just thought we'd at least acknowledge its contribution.
Okay,
so what's number seven?
Well, we'll do six quickly. Let's also acknowledge the 1962 Lotus 25, first monocoque F1 car. So rather than tubes, using a monocoque, lighter, stronger.
And again, it was a revolution in Formula One, but Lancia were making monocoque road cars in the 1920s. Hmm. In sports cars, the D-Type had a semi-monocoque. And yet, they were in Formula One, they're using these spindly little space frames, which were not only nothing like as torsionally rigid as a monocoque. Those early monocoques weren't terribly safe, but they're an awful lot safer than a space frame. So they're just the monocoque was stronger and stiffer and better.
Yeah. Number seven, then I want to talk about this one a little bit.
Go on.
This is the 1966 Lotus 43.
Yes.
And the interesting thing about this is that, interesting for two reasons, but the first I want to talk about is that it used the engine as a stressed member.
It did.
And this goes back to something you mentioned on the podcast a few weeks ago. One of the clever things about Chapman was that he was looking for ways to get individual components to do two jobs, because then you can make the car overall lighter. So it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? You've got this enormous lump of metal in the car. It's heavy. It's strong. Why can't that also be a structural part so that you don't need so much structural stuff around it?
Well, you don't need that enormous subframe, which usually had to carry it.
Yeah. So it's a clever idea. Very clever idea.
Yeah. And also, I particularly wanted that in there because most people think it was the Lotus 49 in the following year, 1967, which was the first to do it. It wasn't. The 43 did it. And then actually, it's just, you know, it seems obvious now, doesn't it? But they just hadn't thought of it until then. So, and I presume you want to talk a bit about the engine itself.
I do. I mean, it's worth saying that the engine that most people think was the first stressed member was the Cosworth DFV, isn't it?
In the 49,
the all-conquering DFV. But actually, the Lotus 43 did it before then. But it used the H16 engine. I can't quite get my head around what that looks like. If you look at animations, and they're online, you can find them, it sort of explains it a little bit more. But you've got 16 cylinders, and two lots of eight, but they sit on top of each other and...
Basically, actually, and now I'm thinking about it, I think the car and the engine were sort of more of BRM's, well, the engine was certainly a BRM engine. BRM have, they were always very innovative and sometimes like the V16 BRM of 1949 when it made its debut was great in theory and terrible in practice. And the H16, so the H16 basically was, there was a new 3-litre formula. And BRM at the time, for the previous formula, the 1.5-litre formula, had an amazingly successful, really good V8. And so someone thought, okay, so we've got a 1.5-litre 8-cylinder engine, and now we need a 3-litre engine. So that's double the capacity, so why not just use two of them and mount them in such a way? And basically, they flattened out the V8, well, they took a lot of the internal components and the design philosophy from their 1.5-litre V8 and turned it into this H16, which was basically two eight-cylinder engines, one sitting on top of the other. How they geared it to the crankshaft and everything, I have no idea. But it is, as far as I'm aware, the one and only H16 engine or H-formation engine that there has ever been. And given that it was incredibly heavy, not very reliable and used vast amounts of fuel, I'm not surprised.
So it's not... I mean, there must have been two flat engines, 280-degree engines, because it's... Yeah. There have been X engines as well, and you can imagine those, two Vs meeting in the middle.
They use those in aircraft, certainly. The predecessor to the Avro Lancaster was a thing called the Manchester, which looks like a Lancaster with only two engines. And that had... an enormous X formation 24-cylinder engine, which is two V12s, one upside down and sharing a common crank. But that didn't work. So they decided to do one with four engines and conventional V12s, and the Lancaster was a result.
The Lotus 43, it definitely didn't work. That was a flop. And there's a lovely line here. The first sign of trouble was when the H16 engine arrived and it required four men to lift it from the truck. You can just imagine them picking up going, oh, no.
Okay, yes.
We may have a problem. I was surprised to see the Porsche 917 on your list.
Only because we're talking about regulations and getting around them and that sort of thing. There was nothing particularly... and Porsche, actually, Porsche very rarely did anything for the first time. They were very rarely the first to do something for the first time. And there's nothing... I mean, the 917 was more powerful, it was lighter, it was faster. It took existing technology to absolute extremes. But there was no individual technology on it which hadn't been done before. The reason I stuck it on the list was that it was created to defy rules that came into existence precisely to stop a car like that ever being created. So, you know, back in the late 1960s, cars were getting faster and faster and faster. You're getting these incredibly exotic prototypes like 7-litre Ford GT40s and Ferrari P4s. And they were getting more and more powerful. They're getting faster and faster, which meant they became more and more dangerous. They became much more difficult for any team of conventional means to oppose. And so they decided that there was going to be this new set of regulations and that you had to build 50 cars to be able to race it. That was then later reduced to 25. And the moment Porsche thought 50, okay, fine. You know, there's nothing we do about that. But 25? Mm. And they just thought, sod it, we'll build them. And so a kind of car, which in previous, you know, years would only, you know, they might have only, I mean, Ferrari, the P4 is a good example. Ferrari, I built, there were some P3s that were converted. I think they actually, but I think genuine 330 P4 Ferraris, I think they built three. Okay, so imagine that was kind of the level. You think, okay, the most we can do with this kind of car is three because they're so expensive and they're so complicated and they're so exotic. And Porsche go, okay, we'll do 25.
Yeah, it's a huge step, isn't it?
There's that photograph, isn't there, of them all lined up outside of ISAC with the inspectors coming to inspect them. Because that was the thing. You couldn't just intend to. You couldn't say, yeah, we'll do it. Here's one, we'll do another 24. You had to do it before you could race any of them. And so Porsche built these 25 cars. I think they then very swiftly unbuilt 24 of them. Because they were literally just thrown together for the inspectors and then had to rebuild them properly. But nevertheless, the cars were there. And I just thought, that's such a good example of, you know, of just thinking, we're not going to be beaten by the regulations. And and once they'd done it, even though this car was even faster and even more exotic and even more exactly the kind of car that they were trying to stop being built, once they'd done it and their 25 cars was, you know, were parked in a line, couldn't stop it racing.
No.
And we know what happened next, and, you know, fair play.
Yeah, finding a way through that regulatory net. That's what this is all about. Okay, so I'm looking at the next few on your list. We have spoken recently about the Brabham fan car. We've spoken in the past about the Tyrrell P34, six wheels. Do you want to talk about the Lotus 72 or the Chaparral 2J?
Okay, well, Lotus 72 was a great piece of design. I'm not going to go on about it for long. The particular innovation on that was, you remember all the Grand Prix cars, they look like those of the 60s. They have those wonderful cigar tube shapes with those big, rounded, open noses. Not aerodynamically particularly friendly. For the 72, the idea was, and they had to be like that because there was the radiator at the front. And for the 72, the idea was put the radiators at the sides. You then take an awful lot of mass out the front of the car, which is exactly where you don't want it. And suddenly you can have that shovel nose, which is just so much more efficient at addressing the air. And it's not one of those sort of great Chapman innovations that gets talked about in the same way that people talk about monocoques or stressed engines or ground effect. But actually, you know, the Lotus 72, first race in 1970, it was still racing in 1975. It did six seasons, won two world championships. Pretty impressive.
Yeah,
indeed. So actually, I think it actually did three constructors, because I think Lotus won the constructors of 73. I might be wrong about that. I just wanted to do that. And the Chaparral 2J, you people probably will have seen this. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go and look at a photograph. And if you've ever been to the Goodwood Festival of Speed, you probably
will.
Is
it the one with the two big fans on the back?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. So this was kind of the idea. In very, very basic terms, Gordon Murray will hate me for saying this, but because the Brabham fan car was a completely different concept. But nevertheless, the idea of using fans to remove the air from underneath the car to literally suck it to the ground, that was pioneered by the Chaparral 2J. And unlike the Brabham, which used the engine to power the fan, the fans on the back of the Chaparral were actually powered by Skidoo engines, I think. I think they were snowmobile engines. But it sealed itself to the ground. It sucked all the air out, and the car was literally suctioned to the ground. And I think it was incredibly quick, but just not reliable. And so it never really came to anything. It was a Can-Am car in 1970, when McLaren were just winning everything with the M8. When would it be the M8D? Briefly, it would have caused everyone to think, "Oh, blimey!" But actually, it never came to anything. But, I mean, probably the ugliest racing car there's ever been, particularly from the back. But wow, what an idea. Fantastic. Yeah,
innovation indeed. Okay, I'm going to skip us forward a couple of decades.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Williams FW14B. It perfected active suspension and traction control. And it was utterly dominant. Won 10 out of 16 races. It won the title, the 92 title for Mansell. And Nigel Mansell was on pole for all but two races that season, which is amazing. It just shows how quick that thing was. And that active suspension was all about a stable aero platform, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. And you know, and that we've obviously skipped past the Lotus 88, but that was the same idea, which was that you have, you know, the Lotus 88. The idea was that you need a platform which doesn't move for the aero, but one which does for the mechanical grip. And so they had two chassis for that, and then Active effectively created did that a different way, didn't it? And so you could provide you could provide a car which addressed the air in a completely consistent way, but because the suspension was incredibly clever, it didn't beat up the driver, so the driver could actually use it. Because the problem with the old ground effect era, you could get a completely stable platform by just putting incredibly stiff springs on the cars, but then the car became undrivable in 1979 with the Lotus 80. They had 2,500 pound springs, and their test driver, who's a bloke I think called Stephen South, one test brought the car in and said, "I can't drive the car because I cannot hold my feet on the pedals." They were just being bounced off the pedals. So yeah, Active made all that go away, and it was just an example of Williams just doing it so much better than anybody else, wasn't it?
Yeah. But did it get banned? Is that what ultimately happened?
Well, the technology got banned. No, the Williams didn't get banned.
Yeah.
And then cars became completely analog, didn't they? But no, I mean, you know, it continued, and it certainly continued in 93, because you remember Senna winning in the wet at Donington in 93. That was a fully active car in the McLaren. I can't remember how many seasons it lasted. Someone will be able to tell us. But it was certainly, you know, they had to wait for a rule change to for it. I wouldn't say it was bad. I would say it was, you know, the rules just kind of, you know, progressed beyond it. And the car certainly wasn't bad, even if the technology was.
I'm just going to quickly list some of the others that you had on your list, but I want to move on to the flops, because they're quite amusing. You had the 1997 McLaren, the MP412, which had the second brake pedal.
Yes.
Which the drivers could squeeze. Was it on the way in or was it on the way out? Was it to pivot the car or was it to aid traction? There's a little bit of uncertainty about that. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was effectively a form of driver-operated torque vectoring.
Yeah. And it came to light when the photographer, Darren Heath, one of the cars broke down, didn't it? And he stuck his camera in the cockpit,
the footwell,
took a shot, and
found three
there
pedals.
Yeah, and it confused everyone. You also had, we've already mentioned the Braun double diffuser, haven't we? And the McLaren F duct. Mercedes dual axis steering.
Just very quickly, the F duct was so clever, because the rule was you couldn't have a movable aerodynamic device on the car. And so the aerodynamic device that moved on the car was the driver, and it was the leg or the elbow, wasn't it, depending which car it was. Which blocked this duct, which stalled the air, which made the car go like, I think they went like sort of thick end of 10 miles an hour faster down the straight as a result. I just thought, I get that. To me, that is just such an incredibly clever piece of lateral thinking. It reminds me of another, and I'll be really quick about this, but the 911 RSR, when that came out, that had torsion bar springs, the 911 did, and you had to retain the original springing medium when what Porsche really wanted was coilovers. And so they suddenly realised that the rule said that while you had to retain the original springing medium, it didn't have to do anything. So they left the old springs in there and then put coilovers in instead. So they're still there, the torsion bars are still there. We have retained the original springing medium. They're not doing anything, but they're still there.
Genius. That's just proper interpretation of the regulations, isn't it? It's what designers are supposed to do.
And somebody else, who was it? Was it Porsche again? A car had to have a place where you could put a spare tyre. And they produced a car which had no space for it. And someone said, well, where do you put the spare tyre? And they went, in the fuel tank. Because the fuel tank was big enough to accommodate a spare tyre. And again, the rules had said you had to be able to do it. You just had to provide a space big enough to house one.
There you go. And they did.
I love all that stuff.
Okay. Flops. We've done a few flops, but we'll do a couple more. The 1978 Brabham BT-46. Now, this one I can't really get my head around. If you can, you might have to explain the technology
a little
bit.
Actually.
Okay. No radiators.
No radiators. No oil radiators. No water radiators. I'd be loved to hear what Gordon's view of this is. This was the 46, which also was the fan car. So the 46 had a fairly extraordinary life. It was a conventional racing car. It was a fan car. And they tested this thing called surface cooling. And the idea was, can you imagine how much weight and bulk and how much more aerodynamic a car would be if it didn't need any radiators? Mm. And so the idea was that you take the radiators away and that you would, and that the surfaces of the cars would effectively be heat exchangers instead. And so you would have an entirely air-cooled car. And it didn't work. Great idea. Just didn't work. But the car, they ran it, and it never raced. So I read somewhere that it only provided like 30% of the cooling capacity that was required, but that may not be true. But lovely idea.
So actually you do need radiators. Apparently in a racing car, there's just so much demand for cooling that you need proper radiators to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to talk about the Aston Martin AMR1, not the Group C car. This is the 2011 ProDrive LMP1 car. It replaced that wonderful V12 coupe, the DBR12, gorgeous thing.
Yes. So we'll still be being on the flops here then.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. This is the floppiest of flops. Now there's no particular individual innovation going on here, like you've suggested, like you said with one of the earlier cars. Everything here had been done already, but it was an unusual technical makeup for the category nonetheless. It was a very different approach to everybody else.
Absolutely. And
so it was all about being light and efficient and slippery. So it had an open top. The Peugeot and Audi LMP1 cars were closed. They decided that was the way to go. Aston Martin wanted to try something different. And it had a downsized, very small, 2-litre turbo straight six petrol. So it completely different to the other cars it was racing up against.
What was a straight six before that last used in a racing car?
Poor.
I mean, 50s?
Really?
You know, at a top level, well, 50s, I mean, I can't think of one. Because the problem with a straight six is that it's very long. And
not all that rigid either, is it?
Rigid, and you get crankshaft, you know, problems with, you know, stopping the crankshaft flailing around, and yeah, but the idea was to create an incredibly efficient aero platform, I presume, with this very long thin engine which didn't get in the way of the airflow in the same way that a V engine would,
and something that would be easy on tyres. So you know they had this whole sort of strategy around this car, but I do remember, I don't know who it was, but I do remember one of the other LMP1 team bosses later saying that they knew the basic concept was flawed, that it couldn't be competitive.
I think it was Beretsky. I think it was Ulrich Beretsky, the Audi engineer bloke, who said that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think he was quite scathing about it. I think he said, I seem to recall him saying, this concept can't work and there's nothing you can do to it that might make it work. For words to that effect.
Ouch. Yeah. And I mention it now because back in 2011, I knew someone who worked at Ilmor, who were involved in the development of the straight six engine. Not publicly, I don't think there's a great deal on record about this. But
I had no idea they'd been involved.
Yeah, months before Le Mans that year, he was telling me it was going to be a disaster, the engine. And guess what happened?
It was a disaster.
The number 9 car retired after 2 laps. And the number 7 car, it spent 4 hours in the pits, but it only covered 4 laps, both with engine problems. It's just amazing that someone was telling
wasn't
me months
also,
before.
Wasn't something else? Wasn't there like a duff batch of pulleys or something? There was something.
That's right. Yeah, they had Ali pulleys and they replaced them with tougher steel ones, but that just sent the issues that they had further downstream.
Further down the line. Yeah. Gosh. Yeah, and I've forgotten about that. Yeah.
And then that car was quickly binned, wasn't it?
Very.
Okay, well, unless there were any others that are leaping out at you on your list that you don't have in front of you, I think we'll move on. No, fine. Well, so last week was episode 100, and it was a bit different, wasn't it? We just took listeners' questions. And it went down well. People enjoyed it. So what we've decided to do, and this was your idea, is answer at least one listener question at the end of every episode. I mean, we've still got a whole load that we didn't manage to get through last week, but we want new questions. Just keep them coming in. However you want to send them, if you want to email us or send us a note on social media, whatever, we just want interesting questions. And that's how we're going to end each episode of the podcast from now on. Before we do that, I just want to say thank you all for listening. Please remember to rate and review the podcast. That's really important. And also subscribe or follow wherever you listen to podcasts. That makes a huge difference. It's the main mechanism by which podcasts grow and find a new audience. So please help us do that. And also check out the Intercooler app. You can start your 1 month free trial right away. But we're going to end this week's episode with a question from Huff755. It's an expansive one. We won't spend ages on it.
Because I have literally no idea what you're about to say.
That's fine. That's good. I've got some notes here. So I've got my answer. You'll be able to do it off the top of your head. He says, what for you makes a car fun to drive?
Oh, we need an entire podcast. We've done an entire podcast on it. How long have you got? Ultimately, the single most important factor in making any car fun to drive is the car's ability to execute the instructions of its driver instantly and accurately. And for that, you need a car particularly which is light. You need a car which is beautifully engineered by people who really understand it. And if you think of all the great driver's cars, they do that. But there are other things too, obviously. You know, you need a great deal of feel. But it comes down to confidence, doesn't it? You know, you will not enjoy a car, however fast it is, whatever its figures are, however much power it has, if it doesn't give you confidence to go and drive it fast, you will not enjoy driving it fast. And that is why, you know, certain cars with very little power can be wildly more fun than certain other cars costing 10 times as much with 10 times the power.
Yep, good. And assuming that we're talking about on the road, you're suddenly looking at a totally different set of characteristics to if we were talking about the track. And I would add that you've said weight, also compact size, but the right amount of grip, by which I mean not too much grip, and a level of performance that you can actually use, because there are few things more frustrating in a performance car on the public road than bundles and bundles of grip that you can't get anywhere near the limit of, and a huge amount of performance that you can only deploy for a couple of seconds at a time. So I think the right level of grip, the right amount of performance, but also dynamic sensation. So you spoke about getting feel from a car, but also I want a car to feel a bit alive underneath me, and I want it to sort of rise and fall over the shape of the road. I do want it to lean a bit in corners, because if a car is just completely clamped down, you don't really feel anything. You're just aware of how quickly you're getting along the road. I prefer to feel the car sort of moving around underneath me. And also, particularly in the case of a front-wheel drive hot hatch, and the Fiesta ST is the best example of this, what's so enjoyable about that car is its balance and how mobile the rear axle is without being just sort of wantonly oversteery. The instant you turn that car into a corner, you find that you're just taking the steering lock off again, because the car is steering as much from the rear as the front, and it's a lovely sensation. And that for me is why that car is one of the most enjoyable road cars at any price.
Excellent.
I reckon we've answered that one.
Yep, great.
Good. Okay, well, yeah, keep your questions coming in and we'll just pick a good one every week. I've done my calls to action as they're known, so all that's left for me to say is thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast. Their details are in the caption below. And we'll be back to talk to you all again next week.
Look forward to it. All the best.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.